HarperCollins presents Love in a Time of War by Adrienne Chin, read by Ruth Sillers. Sisters are different flowers from the same garden. Unknown. Prologue. Christina. Capri, Italy, May 1891. The young woman follows the narrow path, scarcely more than the width of her booted foot, as it winds through the scrub grass that sprouts from the rocky, dust-coloured earth. She skirts around the broom bushes that are heavy with tiny flowers, the colour of the lemons she'd watched the lemonade seller squeeze for her not a half hour earlier. Ahead of her, in the distance, the three jagged stone triangles of the Faraglioni jut out of the glittering blue sea like the teeth of a giant aquatic dinosaur. There is a haze over the water today, which erases the horizon line, so that the world beyond the island's limestone cliffs appears as one large canvas of blue. She comes to rest on a flat rock under the spreading shade of a parasol pine. She looks around to check that she's alone, and when she's assured that she is, she pulls the pale blue skirt of her dress up to her knees and leans over to unlace her boots. When her white stockinged feet are free of the suffocating leather, she wiggles her toes in the breeze that drifts up the cliffs from the sea. The girl has a canvas satchel over her shoulder. She sets it in her lap and unties the leather string. She roots around the lemons inside the bag, and her damp forehead wrinkles in concentration. Ah, yes, there it is. Her fingers curl around the metal body of the pen, a new Waterman fountain pen imported from America, a gift from her father, for your Italian lessons. And she pulls it out with a book. This is bound in fine green Moroccan leather, pressed with curlicues and stylized leaves. Another gift, this one from her late mother's cousin, Stefania Albertini. Meant, she knows, for her to record her Italian grammar while she's on the island for the summer, but really far too pretty to be used for prepositions, conjunctions and interjections. She opens the book and flips through the pages. Only 10 or so are covered in neat blue handwriting, as she'd only been in Capri a week, until a blank sheet of creamy paper appears. Unscrewing the cap of her pen, she bends over the page and writes. A young man stands at the top of the hill. He has been there for some time. If you were to ask him, he wouldn't be able to say how long. He has been watching the figure in the pale blue dress, has been transfixed by the movement of her hand over the pages of the book. And when she removes her hat and the sun draws fire from her auburn hair, he is certain of two things: that she is everything and that he is lost. Part 1. 1913. Chapter 1. The Fries. Clover Bar, London, February 1913. 19-year-old Cecilia Fry gazes out at the rain as it showers down from the lead-grey sky, dousing the back garden of the family home, christened rather romantically Clover Bar by her mother when the scaffolding on the new house had yet to come down, and the garden was nothing more than a quagmire of mud, with an unrelenting drizzle. In the tangled branches of the rowan tree beside the greenhouse, two tiny blue tits, their blue wings flapping as they bounce round their yellow bodies from branch to branch, twitter, seemingly oblivious to the rain. She scans the long garden, noticing the first pale blossom opening on the winter-flowering cherry tree her sister and Jessie and their father had planted the previous year. She frowns at the rivulets of water streaming over the glass panes of the old greenhouse, hoping the putty she'd caulked the seams with in October will solve the leakage, and notes that the Madame Alfred Carrier rose over the arch will need a pruning before the end of the month. A clump of snowdrops has opened under the column of the cedar, and their white, bell-like flowers nod like heads as the silvery droplets rain down. She wonders if it is raining in Heidelberg. She shuts her eyes and waits, with some impatience, as the sparkling blue eyes and the blonde hair, the colour of wheat toasted by July sun, slowly materialise. He's laughing at her. "You haven't finished The Sorrows of Young Werther, Seely? Professor Obermeyer won't be pleased. You know he's in love with Goethe."
"I'm finding Goethe rather hard going, Max."
"Oh, it's Max now, is it? What happened to Herr Fischer, your respected German teacher?"
"You're only 4 years older than me. It's not like your Professor Obermeyer, who looks about 100.
Max laughs. "What is the trouble you're having with Goethe's young Werther?"
"I find Werther's unrequited love for Charlotte terribly upsetting. It's all so emotional."
"Emotional? This is the very core of Sturm und Drang literature. You are a good English girl, Seely Fry, suspicious of passion, always with a stiff upper lip."
"I don't believe I'm like that at all."
The blue eyes twinkle.
"I think sometimes that it's a pity you're a woman." "Whatever do you mean?"
"Professor Obermeyer is quite disturbed that an English woman is top of his German literature class. I heard him complaining to Professor Clem in the Old Crown pub. Obermeyer says you never say a word in his class, though your papers are exceptional."
"You need to have more confidence in yourself, Seely. With a mind like yours, you could be anything if you were a man. Become a professor or a lawyer like I shall."
"I've tried to speak up in class, Max, but everyone talks over me, as if I'm not even there. Why are young men so confident in their opinions?
Anyway, I don't need to run the world. I'm happy enough to be learning German. It brought us together, didn't it?"
"For that, I am most grateful."
"I thought I might teach German at a ladies' college when I'm proficient enough, though I shall have to convince Mama. She thinks me studying German is an awful waste of my time and Papa's money. She says I spend too much time with my nose in books, and says I should be perfecting my piano playing or needlework to become a good wife. Seeing as you have no vocation like Jessie, or artistic talent like Etta." "That's what she said." It quite hurt my feelings. If it weren't for Papa, he always supports all of us girls. He says he wants nothing more than for us to be happy."
"Your father sounds like a good man."
"He is. Do you know why I wanted to learn German, Max?"
"No. Tell me."
"We had a German nanny when I was a little girl, Miss Neumann. She was from Hanover and had very pretty blonde hair. She'd sing us German lullabies, and she taught me and my sister some German words. Schnitzel and strudel and bratwurst. Miss Neumann said apple strudel was her favourite food. Apfelstrudel. I always remembered that. I've wanted to try it ever since.
One day, Schatzi, we shall visit my family in Heidelberg and we shall eat all the apfelstrudel you wish."
"Schatzi?"
Max smiles, and it is like the rising sun cresting a hill. "Sweetheart." She smiles at the memory and moves away from the window. She's been reading too many of Etta's romance novels. She picks up her grey felt hat, newly adorned with pale blue rosette ribbons, and sets it on her head, adjusting the pearl-headed hatpin and tucking away a wayward strand of auburn hair. She shrugs into her grey tweed coat and wraps her new lavender mohair scarf, a Christmas present from the twins, around her neck. Max will be returning from Germany soon, and she will be back to her studies at University College now that her father is on the mend. She's glad she has been able to run his photography studio during his illness, even if it has meant missing the first few weeks of classes. But Jessie certainly couldn't have been expected to interrupt her nursing training, and Etta, well, that would never have worked. As for her mother, Celie smiles at the thought of her mother squinting into a camera lens. What a ridiculous notion. No, it had to be her. Everyone can rely on good old Celie.
Papa's temperature's down. 0.5 degree off normal.
Jessie Fry shakes out the thermometer and slides it into her leather nursing chatelaine beside the tongue depressor and forceps.
He'll be right as rain in no time, Papa.
Gerald Fry struggles to sit up against the stack of fat pillows.
You're a good girl, Jessie. I'm glad we had you.
His wife, Christina, adjusts the pillows behind his head.
Jessica has been an absolute treasure since you fell ill with this fever, Gerald. She will be a credit to King's College Hospital when she graduates this summer.
I have such good daughters. I'm a lucky man.
He points to the pitcher on the bedside table.
Pour me a glass of water, would you, Tina?
My throat is as parched as the Sahara.
Christina fills a glass and sits on the bed. She watches her husband as he drinks. He looks older, she thinks, all of his vitality drained away, like a grape shriveled by the sun. What would have happened if he hadn't recovered from the fever? 3 unmarried daughters, and she doing all she could to hold the household together on Gerald's modest savings. It doesn't bear thinking about.
Gerald hands her the glass. Thank you, my dear. Where's Etta? I miss her sweet face.
Christina and Jessie exchange a look above Gerald's head. Jessie gathers up the dirty sheets.
I have to get back to the hospital, Papa. We're observing an appendectomy this afternoon. If there's peritonitis, it's likely to be quite messy.
Christina shudders, her thick auburn hair threatening to unleash itself from the careful rolls of her pompadour.
Really, Jessica, must you be so graphic?
I have to learn. I've decided I want to become a surgical nurse.
Why ever would you wish to do such a horrid thing?
Christina sweeps her hand behind her ear and taps her hair in an unconscious gesture.
You should be going out and about to exhibitions, recitals with Etta, and meeting other young people, instead of burying your nose in those textbooks day in and day out. Frankly, I'm rather shocked at the content of some of them.
You've looked at my textbooks.
A mother needs to know what her daughters are reading.
How else am I meant to learn anatomy, Mama?
You want me to gad about London like Etta and her art school friends.
We may be twins, but we're nothing alike. We don't even look the same. At any rate, I have no intention of marrying anyone, ever.
Don't be ridiculous, Jessica.
Gerald clears his throat.
Tina?
Mama, this is the 20th century. There are things a woman can do other than marry.
Like what, may I ask?
The world is a big place, Mama, and I intend to see it. I have no intention of ending up married to a boring husband with a brood of children in a house in the London suburbs.
Christina raises a fine, arched eyebrow.
Quite.
Jessie clamps her lips together.
I didn't mean it like that. I just meant I want something different. I want an adventurous life.
Christina rises from the bed and collects the empty pitcher.
I should be very interested to know how you intend to accomplish that on a nurse's salary.
The bedroom door slams against the robins and strawberries wallpapering the wall.
Papa!
18-year-old Etta May Fry flies into the room, her dress a froth of white lace and cotton lawn. She throws her arms around her father and swallows him into her white cloud.
I brought you a present.
She pulls a small red felt bag out of her pocket.
Give me your hand.
Oh, pet, I don't need a present.
Your hand, Papa.
She unties the yellow drawstring and shakes out a small grey stone onto his palm. Jessie huffs.
A stone? All this palaver for a stone, Etta? It's not just a stone, Jessie. Look at it, Papa.
Gerald inspects the flat round shape and the ridges that curve along the spiralling spine.
Hand me my spectacles, pet. Over there, on the table.
Etta sets the spectacles on her father's nose.
There! Very distinguished!
Gerald's long, thin face breaks into a smile under his greying moustache.
An ammonite! Look, Tina!
He points at the spirals and the ridges.
It's a fossil! Millions of years old! From the time of the dinosaurs! This is just wonderful! Wherever did you get this, Etta?
Jenny Bradley's cousin Edith lives in Charmouth, and she's always finding fossils on the beaches down there. Jenny gave it to me.
Christina frowns at Etta's tousled blonde curls.
Etta, where's your tortoiseshell comb? Your hair's all over the place.
Etta tucks the escaping strands behind her ears.
I lost it.
I had better not see it in Jenny's hair the next time she's here for tea.
You won't, Mama,
Etta smiles sweetly at her mother.
I shall tell her not to wear it.
Chapter 2 Jessie King's College Hospital, London, February 1913. Jessie hastens through the iron gates in front of the handsome red brick and grey stone building, the new home of Denmark Hill's pride and joy. So the new king hadn't even officially opened it yet. King's College Hospital. The caretaker tips his cap and ushers her along with an exaggerated sweep of his arms.
Hurry along there, nursie. You don't want matron after you.
Jessie flashes the elderly man a quick smile.
I most certainly don't, Mr. Little. I should make it just in time.
She dashes under the hospital's impressive Doric portico, across the lobby's gleaming terrazzo floor, and up the stairs to the first floor, two at a time. She stuffs her navy wool cape into a cupboard and secures her starched cap over her hair with several hair grips.
Hurry up, Jessie. Matron has her clipboard out.
A plump young nurse, with hair the colour of milk chocolate, grabs her arm and pulls Jessie down the corridor.
It's almost two. It'll be us cleaning the lavatories again, if we're even a minute late. I'm coming, Elsie. You're pulling my arm off.
They push through the heavy swing door into the operating theatre's washing area. The tall, angular figure of the matron stands in the doorway. She taps her clipboard with the rubber end of a pencil.
What am I meant to tell Mr. Goodfellow when my nurses swan into the theatre late? That you've been enjoying a pleasant lunch and lost track of time?
No, matron, Jessie says. We're terribly sorry.
Elsie nods.
Yes, terribly sorry, matron.
It will not happen again. Am I understood?
Yes, matron, understood.
Find a place at the back of the observation stand.
Yes, matron.
Inside the theatre, the surgeon, Mr. Goodfellow, is having a white cotton mask tied onto his face by an attending nurse. The anaesthetist, already swaddled in a clean white gown, though he has eschewed a cap and mask, sits on a metal stool behind the patient's head, shaking out drops of chloroform onto a gauze mask. The patient lies on the operating table under a sheet, moon-faced and wide-eyed, staring at the ceiling. Jessie hears her mumbling as she rushes past.
Hail Mary,
Mother of God, the Lord is with thee.
Jessie follows Elsie onto the observation platform behind the crowd of nursing students. She jabs her elbow into Elsie's side.
Shove over, Elsie. I need to be able to see.
Fry, one moment. I wish to speak to you.
Good luck,
Elsie whispers as she pushes past with the other nursing students.
Yes, matron?
She taps her clipboard with her pen.
I have the results of the anatomy examination. I was quite astonished by the results. Yours, in particular, Fry.
Jessie gulps, her throat suddenly sucked dry of saliva.
I'm in for it now. I should never have gone to the suffragist meeting with Seeley the night before an exam. What was I thinking?
I'm quite accustomed to disappointment in my position, Fry. So many girls enter into the profession without a clear understanding of the skills and fortitude a nurse requires, and I often find myself questioning the motives of some of my charges. I have just heard that Phipps is leaving to marry Dr. Jones Field. You have no such aspirations, I should hope?
Oh, no, matron. I want to be a surgical nurse once I graduate.
You feel you're a suitable candidate for such a demanding specialty? You've been tardy twice this month. What am I meant to think about your dedication?
I'm terribly sorry. My father's been ill with a fever. I've been nursing him at home. The tram and bus from Hither Green aren't always on time.
The matron sniffs.
He's much better now.
The senior nurse peers across the top of the document at Jessie.
You've achieved a perfect grade on the anatomy examination, Fry. This is the first time this has been accomplished.
I did?
The matron narrows her eyes.
Are you certain you wish to specialise as a surgical nurse? It's extremely demanding. It requires a great deal of stamina.
Oh, yes. I have a strong constitution.
I nursed for the British Army in South Africa during the Boer War. That required quite a strong constitution. Have you considered joining the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Military Nursing Service? I am involved on its executive committee, and I believe you might be a suitable candidate.
Become an army nurse? But we're not at war.
Not currently. Consequently, we have only 300 nurses trained for military nursing, which is woefully inadequate should the situation change. Should you be selected, you would continue with your surgical training here at King's, but as a Queen Alexandra's nurse, until such time as you are required abroad.
Abroad?
Of course. Wars are generally fought abroad. I should like to put your name forward to the committee.
Jessie's heart beats a drum in her chest.
That would be... Yes. Yes, please.
The matron's dark eyebrows draw together.
Army nursing is a difficult life for a young woman. You are posted wherever the army needs you. Your life isn't your own. You mustn't fraternise with doctors or soldiers. If you marry, you must leave the service.
That suits me perfectly. I don't intend to marry any time soon, if ever.
The nurse nods.
What will your parents think of this?
They'll be fine. They're very supportive.
The matron eyes Jessie. She scribbles something onto the document.
I'm recommending you for immediate advancement into the surgical specialty. I suspect we may need trained surgical nurses sooner rather than later. The world is not a peaceful place, Fry. I believe war is inevitable.
Chapter 3. Christina. Capri, Italy, June 1891. Christina Bishop wanders past the lemonade stand on the Via Matteotti, where she'd bought the lemons earlier in the day. Its green-tiled counter is laden with baskets of fat yellow lemons
and oranges as large as grapefruit. Bunches of fragrant lemons dangle from the woven cane canopy that shades customers from the searing sun. Behind the counter, a sturdy, middle-aged caprese, with a crop of ink-black hair shiny with a slick of pomade, puts his fingers to his lips and kisses them with a loud, smacking sound. He holds up a glass and a lemon.
Buona giornata, signorina. Sei bellissima. Vuoi un bicchiere di limonata?
No. No, grazie. Molto grazie. The man laughs.
Non com quello. No, grazie mille, Leonardo. Non voglio un bicchiere di limonata.
He urges her, with a roll of his hand, to repeat.
He's saying, no thank you, Leonardo. I don't want a glass of lemonade.
Christina looks behind her. A young Englishman in a beige linen suit, which, though impeccably tailored, seems somehow at odds with his sturdy shoulders and solid body, lifts his straw boater and inclines his head. He smiles and waves at the lemonade seller.
Pronto, Leonardo!
Leonardo grunts. Muttering, he saws through a lemon with a large knife.
Thank you, but I know what he said.
Christina turns and heads down the cobbled lane. The Englishman falls into step beside her.
I'm terribly sorry. I shouldn't presume. You simply looked rather confused. I could tell from your accent that you're not Italian.
My mother is Italian. She was born here in Capri.
Surely your mother must speak Italian to you at home.
Mama passed away in February. The Russian flu.
A shadow falls across the young man's face.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry.
He stops abruptly in the middle of the lane.
I've been incredibly rude. You must be wondering who this bloody fellow is.
Not particularly.
Dash it. And I've been so hoping to make a good impression. I have to remind myself I'm not with the rowing chaps at Cambridge.
He extends a hand.
I'm Harry. Harry Grenville.
I really must be going.
He drops his hand.
Yes, of course. Are you
in Capri for long? Christina sweeps a cool blue gaze over the young Englishman.
Good day, Mr. Grenville. Thank you for the help with the lemonade, though. As I said, it wasn't required.
She heads down the lane, her pale blue dress swinging around her black-booted feet.
Are you on the island for the summer? He shouts after her.
She pauses at the turning into Via Federico Serena and looks back up past the Via Matteotti's bougainvillea-lined garden walls.
Until the end of September.
Harry's heart leaps.
What's your name?
A smile tugs at the corners of her mouth.
Christina!
He whoops and throws his hat into the air, but it catches on the sprawling branches of an arbutus tree. He turns towards the auburn-haired girl, but she is gone, though the music of her laughter floats up the lane through the rosemary-scented air. The iron gate into the tiny front garden of the Villa Serenissima creaks as Christina pushes it open. She glances up the street, but sees no sign of the young Englishman. A judder of disappointment takes her by surprise.
How silly. I'll probably never see him again.
Tina? Is that you?
Christina shuts the gate and climbs the stone steps. The patio is paved with terracotta tiles, which are chipped and faded by years of exposure to the Caprese weather. Pots of musky-scented scarlet pelargoniums cluster around the edges of the patio, and a small marble fountain with its water-spilling cupid adds a looping aquatic melody to the shaded spot.
Si, Cugina Stefania, it's me,
Stefania Albertini greets her in the loggia outside the villa's arched front door. The woman, no taller than Christina's shoulders, even accounting for her black bouffant pompadour, is dressed in a high-necked white shirt with full sleeves and ruffles across her full bosom, and her long navy linen skirt is cinched, as much as her stout waist will allow, with a wide brown leather belt.
"You have the lemons, Tina. Liliana has been waiting for 2 hours to make a torta caprese bianca."
"Yes, I have them. Lovely fat ones from Leonardo."
She kisses her mother's cousin lightly on her plump cheeks.
"Leonardo? Who's Leonardo?"
"The lemonade seller."
Christina digs into her satchel and produces a lemon. The skin is waxy and lumpy in her hand. Stefania ushers Christina across the lobby's glazed floral tiles, decorated with exuberance by some 18th-century ceramicist from Vietri sul Mare on the Amalfi Coast, in hues of vivid blue and yellow, and into the large, white-painted sitting room. Underneath its soaring vaulted ceiling, the room is filled with heavily carved antique Baroque walnut furniture, waxed by the housekeeper Liliana to a high sheen. 2 large settees, upholstered in mint-green silk damask, fraying along the arms where the sunlight persists in eating away the fibres, face each other across a large Persian rug. A light breeze drifts in from the balcony beyond the sitting room and brushes across Christina's damp face like a lover's caress.
"Go sit outside where it's cool, Tina. We'll have some tisana and speak Italian."
Stefania reaches out to take the satchel from Christina.
"One minute, I need my notebook and pen."
Stefania checks the gold metal watch pinned to her ruffled blouse with an impatient sigh as Christina roots around inside the satchel.
"You are learning well about Italian time, cara mia. The lemons will start growing into trees in that bag."
"I'm sorry."
Christina retrieves the items and hands her cousin the satchel. Stefania nods.
"When I come back, you can tell me what you did for the past 2 hours while we were waiting for the lemons."
She strides across the Persian carpet toward a doorway at the far end of the vaulted sitting room, her skirt swishing around her ankles.
"Liliana! Liliana! Finalmente ho i limoni!"
Chapter 4. Seeley. Blackheath Halls, London. February 1913.
"Etta! Hurry up! Don't forget your pin!"
Seeley checks her reflection in the hallway mirror and adjusts the red, white and green National Union of Women's Suffrage Society's pin on the lapel of her tweed coat. Etta clomps down the carpeted stairs and exhales a dramatic sigh.
"Do I have to come? It's so boring. All these women going on and on about the vote. What does it really matter? We've all managed perfectly fine all these years the way it is."
"The NUWSS ladies have important things to say, Etta," Seely says, as she pins an NUWSS pin onto Etta's coat lapel.
"The least we can do is take one night out of our week to listen to them." "I guess."
Jessie pulls on her gloves.
"Why should we intelligent, capable women give away our autonomy, our feminine voices, to the patriarchal society that holds us in chains, Etta?" "You sound just like Christabel Pankhurst in The Suffragette, Jessie. What do you expect when your own government is jailing and beating women for voicing their opinions? What they're doing to those poor women on hunger strike is outrageous. You do want to be heard, don't you, Etta?"
Etta tugs on her kid gloves.
"I suppose."
Christina emerges from the sitting room, her grey wool skirt sweeping along the polished encaustic tiles. A wrinkle draws a fine line across her pale forehead.
"You're not going to another one of those suffragist meetings, are you?
Yes, Mamma, Celie says,
as she pushes aside the brocade curtain over the front door.
We won't be late. It's only over at Blackheath Hall's. Why don't you come? Mayor Jackson's wife is always there.
Why in the world would I wish to associate myself with mentally unstable women?
What do you mean?
You know as well as I do that we women have monthly issues which affect our emotional state. Jessie grunts. What has that got to do with anything? I wouldn't wish to be governed by a woman in an emotional state, would you, Jessica?
Queen Victoria managed it for over 60 years. And there was Elizabeth the First, Etta pipes in.
Christina huffs. They were queens. They hardly count.
They were women, just as you or I, Mamma, Celie says.
Be that as it may, I think giving women the vote upsets the natural balance of femininity, Cecilia. We have our own natural sphere of influence in our homes and with our families. I don't understand why you can't be satisfied with that. You can wield all the power you wish in the home.
We're not married, Mamma, Jessie says. Ergo, we're powerless.
Once you're married, that will all change.
Then we're held hostage by our husband and children. That's why I want to be a nurse. I want to be in control of my life.
Honestly, Jessica, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Being a wife and a mother is a joy.
Celie slides an umbrella out of the brass umbrella stand. I want that too, Mamma. Truly I do. But I feel I have every right to have a say in the running of my own country. Women in New Zealand and Australia have been given the vote. Why not here?
Christina harumphs. Former penal colonies? They are hardly the best of examples, Cecilia.
Jessie rolls her eyes. As long as the government quashes every suffrage bill that is tabled, I'll be going to these meetings.
She beckons to Etta, who has slumped to a seat on the carpeted stairs. Are you coming?
Etta rises from the step with a yawn. Yes, I'm coming, but don't expect me to chain myself to any railings.
Miss Fry, if I may have a word?
Celie turns toward the woman's voice. The slender figure of the organization's revered founder approaches through the crowd.
Millicent Fawcett extends her hand to Celie. I'm delighted to make your acquaintance, Miss Fry.
She clasps Celie's hand in a firm grip and points towards a pair of wooden chairs.
Come, let's sit. I have a proposal which I wish to discuss with you.
Celie's heart beats so loudly that she's sure the esteemed Mrs. Fawcett can hear it.
Mrs. Fawcett, if I may say how much of an honour it is to...
Enough of that, Miss Fry.
Mrs. Fawcett sits down, her back as straight as a walking stick. Although she is well past 60, not a strand of grey threads the deep chestnut brown of the woman's neatly pinned up hair.
I want to say, Miss Fry, how impressed I was by your comments during the meeting this evening. I, too, believe very strongly that something must be done to rehabilitate the image of the suffrage campaign.
She shakes her head, and the fine lines that crease her high forehead deepen.
Our cause has become stained by the militancy of some of our compatriots in Mrs. Pankhurst's society. I believe that our cause will only succeed if people sympathise with it rather than fight against it.
Celie's stomach flutters.
Yes, I couldn't agree more, Mrs. Fawcett.
I have no doubt whatever that we must support our movement by argument based on common sense and experience, and not by personal violence or law-breaking of any kind.
Yes, of course.
Mrs. Fawcett exhales a deep sigh.
I believe
that in order to succeed in our mutual endeavour of securing votes for women, the NUWSS should organise a peaceful, joyful event of solidarity. Mrs. Pankhurst's members will be welcome, so long as they understand that this is to be a peaceful event. We're proposing a march, Miss Fry.
A suffragist march?
Mrs. Harley of the Shropshire Society of the NUWSS proposed the idea, and I believe a march of peaceful suffragists, women and men, to London from all corners of Britain would be just the thing to turn the tide of public opinion in our favour. We shall march to Hyde Park, where we shall hold a suffragist rally. And from there, I shall lead a deputation to Prime Minister Asquith himself at Downing Street. He will see that women are people as well as men, that we have the right to be seen as human beings with a voice.
Celie's breath catches in her throat. Yes, absolutely, Mrs. Fawcett. This is exactly what is needed. What can I do to help?
You, Miss Fry, will help me organise it.
Celie stretches her arms as the final notes of Macushla fade away. She sits back on the piano stool and stares at the ivory keys. She tinkles two keys, then stops abruptly.
Mama?
Christina looks up from the purple iris she is embroidering on a large square of white linen.
Yes, Cecilia?
Celie spins around on the stool.
When you met Papa, how did you know he was the one you would marry? Did you know right away?
Christina slides the needle through the linen and pulls the purple thread through. Your father was a very nice man. And kind. Very kind.
Of course. But when did you know he was the one who was set on this earth for you? When did you know you would marry Papa?
Christina glances over at her daughter. Love is not always what you might think, Cecilia. The corners of her mouth twitch.
It was when he bought me a box of chocolate cannoli from Taroni's. Cannoli. You fell in love with Papa because of cannoli.
Chocolate cannoli. Christina snips the thread and pulls a purple strand off a thick skein of wool. Celie taps at a piano key.
Do you think love can survive separation?
Christina sets the embroidery in her lap.
Why ever are you asking a question like that? I... Well, there's a young man. His name is Maximilian Fischer. He teaches the German classes at University College.
A German?
Yes. He's in Heidelberg at the moment, visiting his family. His little stepbrother broke his leg skiing.
Christina peers at her daughter.
Who exactly is this Maximilian Fischer? You'd like Max. Mr. Fischer, Mama. He's ever so polite. His contract at University College ends next year. Then he's planning to return to Heidelberg to study law.
Surely there must be a nice young Englishman in one of your classes who would be more appropriate.
Mama, Max and I, we have an understanding.
Christina's fine eyebrows shoot skyward.
An understanding? Has he proposed? Without speaking to your father first?
No, no, nothing like that.
I see.
Christina yanks the purple thread through the needle.
He's been a gentleman.
Celie's eyes widen.
Of course. He's a perfect gentleman, Mama. The thing is, he's returning to Germany for the summer, and Mrs. Fawcett of the NUWSS has just asked me to help her organise a suffragist march and a rally in Hyde Park this July. I'd been hoping.
A march? You won't be chaining yourself to railings.
Oh, no. Mrs. Fawcett doesn't believe in violent means. She believes we need to cultivate the support of the population and of government rather than ostracize people. It's a huge honour to be singled out like this by her. The thing is...
And you feel capable of taking on such a task? You never struck me as a leader.
The thing is, Mama, I had hoped that I might go to Heidelberg to take an advanced German course this summer.
Christina drops her needlepoint into her lap. You cannot be serious, Cecilia.
You said that I should be braver, like Jessie, or get out more, like Etta, Mama. I found a rooming house for women students. It's not dear at all. Papa thought it might be all right.
Your father's agreed to this folly.
He said it would be all right, if you agreed. I haven't told Max yet. I wanted to speak to you first. Papa said he'd take the train to Paris with me, then set me on the train to Heidelberg. Max will meet me there. It's all perfectly safe.
I absolutely do not agree to this, Cecilia. Travelling across Europe without a chaperone, into the arms of a...
She picks up the needlepoint and stabs the needle into the heart of the iris.
It sounds to me that this marching project has come along at quite an opportune time, Cecilia. Our Lord is looking out for you.
You think I should stay in London and help organise the march?
I have no doubt it will be a stretch for you, but I think it is by far the best option.
Celie ponders the piano keys as an uneasy silence settles over the sitting room.
Chapter 5. The Fries. Hither Green, London, March 1913.
Etta ducks under a string, hung with drying sepia photographs of new mothers with fat babies dressed in puffy white dresses, serious, moustachioed men in their best suits, and newlyweds looking to their futures with frowns of consternation. The studio's glass-panelled ceiling is hung with white sheets that her mother has sewn together into one large swathe of fabric, which can be raised or lowered over the window on a pulley system. A mahogany full-plate camera, the size of a coal box, a recent acquisition by her father from Marion and Company in Soho Square, sits, draped with a paisley shawl, astride a wooden wheeled tripod, its brass lens aimed at a painted backdrop of a rural idyll. Scattered around the room, wicker chairs, potted ferns, busts, branchwood settees, oriental screens, bassinets, parasols and rugs await their selection for the next photography session at Frederick J. Fry and Son, Photographers. She drops her wet umbrella into a Chinese ceramic urn and unbuttons her coat. Papa? Celie? Where are you?
Her father answers from behind a black velvet curtain. In here, dove. Cleaning the camera plates.
Etta hurries across the old Persian rug, which Celie has arranged so that the fraying end is well out of view of the camera's lens, and pulls open the curtain.
Gerald Fry looks up from the enamel sink, where he's scraping excess gelatin emulsion off the back of a glass plate. Careful, pet. Don't knock over the developing fluid. Celie, where's the lid?
Celie reaches into her apron pocket and hands the lid to her sister. Etta, put this on the bottle, will you please?
She pours a splash of bleach into a copper tub full of water.
The bath's ready, Papa.
He hands Celie the glass plate. Then he glances at Etta, who is shuffling through a stack of recent prints. Have you come to help, dove?
Etta laughs, the sound floating like fairground music over the studio's industrious silence.
Heavens, no! I'm off to my painting lesson in Camberwell. Mama asked me to stop by and remind you that Mr. Jeffreys and his son from the auctioneers are coming for dinner tonight. She asked if you can pick up some cheese on your way home. Good cheese. And not to be late. They're coming at 6:30.
I'll wager Mama will sit you beside Mr. Jeffrey's son, Etta, Celia says, as she hands the clean glass plate to her father.
How do you fancy being an auctioneer's wife?
I don't fancy it at all. I intend to live an artistic life, full of interesting bohemian people.
Gerald sets the glass plate in a wooden rack to dry.
I fear young Mr. Jeffreys won't be meeting his future Mrs. Jeffreys this evening. Your mother is destined to be disappointed once again.
Thomas Jeffreys stabs his mahogany cane into the puddle at the omnibus stop on Hither Green Lane and eases his bulk off the bus's step and onto the pavement. He adjusts his black felt derby over his thick head of white hair and draws up the collar of his black wool coat.
Blasted weather! It's cold enough to freeze Perry's dogs!
Thomas's eldest son, Frank, steps off the bus and dodges the puddle.
I expect Commander Perry's dogs would find this to be rather on the balmy side for them, Father, being as they were from the Arctic.
This cab strike nonsense is a bloody nuisance. How's anyone meant to get anywhere?
Frank points at the bus lumbering south, the Oakey's knife polish advertisement on the back bouncing with every dip of a tyre into a watery pothole.
By taking the omnibus, Father. How the other half lives.
Thomas removes his pince-nez and wipes the steamed lenses on his cashmere scarf. He sets the spectacles back on his nose and runs his hand down his meticulously groomed white beard.
I'm far too old to be interested in how the other half lives, Frank. Come the new year, I shall have my feet up in my study in Nuneaton, doing crosswords and reading the papers, and you, my son, will have the joy of running the London office.
He taps his nose.
Which reminds me, we must stop into Christie's tomorrow morning and see Mr. Jameson about the William III desk we have in storage. No doubt they can sell that to one of the Mayfair lot for a pretty penny. Your mother has her heart set on a new bathroom suite, complete with a red enamel bath, and Mrs. Jeffrey's aspirations are my directives. When you have a wife, you'll understand this.
Frank stops in front of a handsome bay-windowed semi-detached house. Three pollarded cherry trees stand sentinel behind the beige London brick wall. He pushes open the black iron gate and ushers his father ahead of him along the black and white tiled path. Thomas rings the doorbell.
I'll wager you 5 shillings they'll serve roast chicken.
5 shillings? My wages won't stretch to that. My employer is tight.
You have free room and board, and a laundry service, and a very nice house in Pimlico. You have no need for a great deal of money, my boy. Money only causes young men to get into trouble.
Millie Smith, the Fry's maid of all work, ushers the Jeffreys men into the sitting room and disappears down the hallway, carrying their hats and coats. Gerald rises from his favourite leather armchair and sets down the Illustrated London News as he extends his hand to the senior Mr. Jeffreys.
Gentlemen, I'm delighted to welcome you to our home. Come, come, do have a seat. It's so much nicer to discuss business in this environment than in an office, wouldn't you agree?
Thomas Jeffreys settles into an armchair, slip-covered in a cheerful floral chintz, while Frank finds a perch at the end of the chaise longue, which sits pride of place in the centre of the room. Thomas points at the newspaper as Gerald sits in his chair.
What do you think about this airship scare? They're saying the Germans sent one over Sheerness in October. It's just a matter of time before the eastern sky is full of them, I say.
Gerald opens the newspaper to the double-page spread.
It says here that there have been reports of airship sightings all over Britain this winter. Figments of people's imagination, I should think, Frank says.
Thomas raises a thick white eyebrow and throws his cool grey gaze at his son.
Do you now, Frank? What has made you such an expert on the subject?
Frank clears his throat. The Spectator and The Economist had articles on this very subject this week. The consensus is that people are panicking and their imaginations are running away with them. They're not even sure that the Sheerness incident wasn't just a lost pilot from the Navy's flight training school in Eastchurch. Thomas sniffs loudly.
If Germany wishes to send airships over Britain, there's no one to stop her, since we're so far behind in the air. One of these days we may wake up, mark my words.
As Christina sweeps into the room from the hallway, the men rise in unison. What's all this about airships, Gerald? We're meant to be discussing the sale of Papa's furniture, aren't we, gentlemen? Gerald smiles at his wife. She is dressed in the maroon silk dress he liked so well, and her auburn hair in its pompadour shines with a golden lustre in the gaslight. 2 years past 40, and still as beautiful as the day she'd walked into his father's photographic studio over 20 years before.
Christina, my dear, may I introduce Mr. Thomas Jeffreys and his son, Mr. Frank Jeffreys, from Jeffreys Auctioneers?
Delighted, gentlemen. She gestures towards the hallway. If I may interrupt what sounds like a fascinating discussion, Millie has prepared a delicious dinner for us this evening. Our daughters will be joining us. I do hope you like roast chicken.
Gerald pulls back the bed covers and slips into the large brass bed beside Christina.
That was a success, I should think.
Christina sets down her novel.
Do you think so?
I do. I managed to talk the old man down to a 5% commission. We should easily afford the storage fees we've been accumulating on your father's furniture over the past 18 months. Why did my horrid Aunt Henrietta feel she had any right to contest Papa's will? It's because of Mama, I'm sure of it. The aunts never accepted her.
Of course they did.
No, they didn't. The Catholic daughter of an Italian plasterer. She was never going to accept me as Papa's heir.
You have no worries about that now, my dear. Her claim has been thrown out of the court.
But she has the house. That beautiful house in Portman Square and the Yorkshire house. What does she need with two houses? She's on her own since Aunt Margaret passed away.
The house was in your grandfather's name, not in your father's. And we have a house, a very nice house,
in Hither Green. She glares at her husband, below the Thames. Gerald leans across the bed and gives his wife a peck on her cheek.
Good night, my love.
He settles back against the pillow and, after tugging the covers up to his chin, shuts his eyes. Christina examines her husband's exhausted face.
I'm sorry, Gerald. Clover Bar is a very nice house. She picks up her book, the latest from Mrs. Glynn, and closes the cover.
Poor Etta tried so hard with that young Frank Jeffreys.
Gerald grunts.
He's duller than a Victorian shilling. His father has him under his thumb.
At least she tried. Jessica spent the evening with her nose in a book and was exceptionally rude when she did say anything. Imagine asking him how he should like to be force-fed through a tube for expressing his convictions. I feel I must apologise to young Mr. Jeffreys. She's such a strong-willed girl.
Just like her mother.
I was never like that. Gerald rolls his head toward his wife.
Celie made an effort to smooth things over with Mr. Jeffreys. She's a safe pair of hands.
Gerald, did you tell Cecilia she could study in Germany this summer? I have no intention of permitting my daughter to gallivant across Europe unaccompanied. Gerald sits up against the pillows.
She's told you about her young man, Mr. Fisher.
I seem to be the last one to hear about him. How could you countenance such an idea? We would be throwing her into the arms of a dubious young German.
Is that what you want? Our daughter to end up compromised?
Seeley is a very sensible young woman. You have nothing to fear on that account. I know that young men cannot be trusted. I shall not have her going to Germany this summer. Is that understood, Gerald?
Understood, Tina.
She's told me she's been asked to help organise some march in London for the suffragists this summer. I told her I thought it was a good idea. She needs to find something she's good at. She doesn't seem to have any particular talents that I've noted.
Seely has quite a good eye for photography, Tina.
What kind of skill is that for a woman?
I thought you didn't approve of the suffragettes, my dear. They're by far the lesser of two evils.
Gerald rubs his hand over his eyes.
You're her mother. You know best.
He settles under the covers and rolls onto his side.
Good night, my dear.
Christina stares at the back of her husband's head, at the thinning brown hair threaded with grey. The problem is the past is still alive inside her. She carries it with her every second of every minute of every hour. She will never be free of her past. It stares her in the face every day, every time she looks at Cecilia. She can't let Cecilia make the same mistake with Maximilian Fischer that she'd made herself during that long, hot summer in Capri. Chapter 6. Max. Heidelberg, Germany, March 1913.
So then the captain handed me a Mannlicher rifle and said, "Shoot at the dummy!"
Friedrich Münster, Fritz to his friends, spears a slice of sausage with his fork.
"I've never held a rifle in my life, and I was meant to shoot it."
A cherub-faced student in the same grey military uniform as Fritz's sets his stein of beer on the wooden table and pulls up a chair.
"It was funny. Someone drew a moustache on the dummy and put a French beret on its head."
Max frowns.
"Dieter, that's really not called for."
Fritz slices through a sausage.
"Everyone knows the French hate us, Max. They're still mad about us taking Alsace and Lorraine from them in the last war. When the next war starts, the English should join us. The French don't like them either."
"Calm down, Fritz. There isn't going to be a war. Nobody has to take sides here." Fritz looks at Max as he chews his sausage.
"Spoken like a true diplomat, Professor.
You could learn from Max, Dieter. You don't have to hit people over the head with your opinions all the time. Don't the English have a saying, 'You catch more flies with honey than vinegar?'"
"Dieter, Max is right. You shouldn't joke about the French like that." Max nods at the young blonde woman sitting beside Fritz.
"Thank you, Annalisa. At least somebody's on my side."
"Of course." Annalisa takes a sip of her beer. "Even though nobody likes the French."
"Annalisa!"
"Well, it's true. Though they do make lovely dresses." "Does your girlfriend wear lovely dresses, or does she look like one of the dumpy English girls with their sturdy shoes and their tweed skirts?"
"Seely is a very nice girl in every way, Annalisa."
Fritz throws a lanky arm around Max's shoulders.
"Max, Max, you've been captured. I can see that. Maybe I should go to England and get myself an English girl. I can speak it a little."
He clears his throat and says in an exaggerated English accent,
"Good day, madam. Would you care to join me for a cup of tea?" "That's good, isn't it?"
"I don't think that will get you very far, Fritz.
Perhaps I need to be more romantic."
Fritz reaches into his pocket and pulls out a thin sheet of paper. He unfolds it and reads,
My lovely Schatzi.
Max grabs for the letter. Give me that, Fritz.
Schatzi, did you hear that?
Dieter says, as he chews on a sausage.
Did you kiss her yet?
Oh, do be quiet, Dieter, Annalisa says. Fritz holds the letter out of Max's reach.
My lovely Schatzi, you were in my dreams last night. We were walking along the Neckar River by the old bridge, and your hair shone like fire under the moonbeam.
Max grabs the letter and shoves it into his breast pocket.
Where did you get it, Fritz?
It was in the pocket of the jacket you lent me the other day when I took Annalisa to the cinema.
Of course I read it. Don't be so sensitive.
Max pushes his empty plate away.
It's been a long day. I had a meeting at the Landsturm office. It looks like I shall be joining all of you next year when I'm finished with my teaching contract in London. They won't let me put off my military training any longer.
Fritz thumps Max's arm.
Finally, the professor joins the soldiers.
Max pushes away from the table. I'm going home. I'll see you tomorrow. Max crosses a small cobbled courtyard and runs up the brick steps to the Fisher's townhouse on Sandcastle Street. The front door is pulled open before he can turn the doorknob.
Frau Knopfler, you surprised me.
Come in, Maximilian. I saw you coming across the courtyard. There's a letter for you on the hallway table. Do you want some coffee? I've picked a lovely plum tart.
The housekeeper pinches Max's cheek.
Your favourite.
As she speaks, her jowls wobble, and the lace ruffles of her voluminous blouse quiver over her generous bosom. Max hangs his grey wool flat cap on a wall hook.
You're spoiling me, Frau Knopfler. Mama and Papa will be back from the hospital soon with Hans. He will miss his cast. I think he had everyone in Heidelberg sign it.
Perhaps we should wait.
Shall I cut you a small piece of plum tart for now? It's fresh out of the oven.
Only if you have a piece as well. Why don't you make some coffee, and I'll be down in a quarter of an hour.
A wide smile breaks across the housekeeper's broad face.
You'll want cream, of course, with the tart.
What is plum tart without cream?
He grabs the white envelope off the lace table runner and dashes up the stairs. Once he is safely inside his bedroom, he tosses his leather satchel onto the single bed and tears open the letter.
Clover Bar, Hither Green Lane, Hither Green, London. February 22nd, 1913. My dearest Max, I hope you are well, and that Frau Knopfler is not making you fat with her strudels and dumplings. Papa is so much better now. He has been back working in the studio for the past fortnight, though I ensure he doesn't overtire himself. I have been relegated back to scenery arranger and glassplate cleaner when I'm not back at the college, which is a shame, as I quite enjoyed experimenting with Papa's new dry-plate camera. Etta was a very willing model. She's quite taken with the American film actress Miss Lillian Gish, and has begun wearing her hair long and draping herself in silk shawls. Mama does not approve, as you can imagine. I am so looking forward to your return next month. Professor Obermeier makes her a very stern German language professor. He disapproves of my accent. He says I sound like an Austrian.
Is that a bad thing?
You know, I was hoping to study in Heidelberg this summer. My father has agreed, so long as Mama does as well. But Mama is not so easy to convince, though I do not think it's altogether impossible, given time. I've told both of them about you, Max. About us. It's no longer a secret, which is a relief. I can't bear secrets. The thing of it is, something has happened now which has put my mind in a spin. Women's suffrage is a cause which I feel quite strongly about, as you know. I attended a meeting recently where we were very fortunate to have the Society's leader, Mrs. Fawcett herself, speaking. I had occasion to comment during the meeting, which brought me to Mrs. Fawcett's attention. She asked to speak with me after the meeting. My heart was beating so rapidly, I expected it to leap right out of my body. Mrs. Fawcett has asked me to help her organise a suffragist pilgrimage to London this summer, which shall end with a huge rally in Hyde Park. It is such a great honour, and I am flattered beyond belief. Of course, there is you, my dearest Max. I have been dreaming of walking with you on the Philosopher's Walk, the Philosophen Weg, I think you call it, and standing on the old stone bridge, watching the water of the Neckar River flow beneath our feet. I have imagined meeting your friends, Fritz and Dieter, eating schnitzel and strudel in Seppel, and meeting your family, of course, particularly little Hans. My dearest Max, I have been anguishing for the past week about this. I hope you understand my decision, but I have decided to stay in London this summer to help Mrs. Fawcett and to make myself useful in Papa's studio. The fever has taken quite a lot out of him. I've also thought about how you say I should be braver and get involved with life, rather than watching it from behind my notebooks. The march will be the perfect opportunity for me to do this. The thought of it is making me quite nervous, I must confess. Let's speak about it when you're back in London. We shall have the spring together, Max. England does spring so very well. We shall both be busy this summer, me with the march, and you studying for your law school entrance examination. The months will fly by, you will see. September will arrive before you know it, and we shall have another glorious year together over verbs and declensions. With loving fondness, Seeley.
Max folds the sheets of the letter and slides them back into the envelope. Rising from the bed, he walks over to the small wooden table stacked with papers and textbooks. He sets the envelope on top of the university library's copy of the Odyssey, picks up his fountain pen, and sits down on the faux bamboo chair. Sandgasse, 10, Heidelberg, Germany. March 6th, 1913. Dearest Seeley, please do not worry about anything. I understand completely. I shall miss you every day this summer, Schatzi. I am already counting the seconds until I see you again. 1, 2, 3. There, you see? I am thinking I shall join the football club here this summer. You are quite right about Frau Knopfler and her cakes. She has just baked a Quetschekuchen. I can smell it now, and you know how much I love plums. I shall be as large as Herr Obermeier if I am not careful. Therefore, the football, I think. 4, 5, 6. I am still counting. Only one more week, and I shall be back in London. Your loving Max. P.S. Why are you so far away from me?